stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the IBM Compliance, Not Just for DBAs, conference call. Today's call is being recorded. For opening remarks and introductions, I'd like to turn the call over to Ms. Diane McCollum. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Welcome, everybody, to Compliance, Not Just for DBAs. My name is Diane McCollum, and I am the worldwide sales leader for IBM's DB2 4Z and DB2 and IMS tools. I will be your host today. Our speakers are Elaine Morelli, a certified technical sales specialist for DB Tools for Z. And Elaine is a part of the IBM software group. And then we have Ernest Mansell, also a certified technical sales specialist for DB2 Tools for Z, and also a part of IBM software group. We welcome them both. Now I'd like to turn it over to Ernie. Ernie?
Thank you, Diane, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We will be using the presentation that hopefully you've downloaded from the website. Periodically, I'll be mentioning the slide number so everyone can stay up with the presentation. So we should be on slide 2. Our agenda today is that we'll take a brief look at the regulatory challenges and landscape that all of y'all are probably facing today. We'll talk about some specific technology that might help you manage and meet the regulatory challenges, data encryption, protection of data, analyzing and auditing data. We'll show two different possible solutions from the auditing perspective. Elaine Morelli will present a new technology that was just announced this week, the Audit Management Expert, and then she'll hand the presentation back over to me where we'll discuss archiving audit data. So one housekeeping note, some of the slides you'll see bullet items that are grayed out. Those are intended for to provide you with some additional background information, but we're probably not going to be discussing those points during our presentation today. So we should be on slide 3. And this is just a list of all of the different regulatory compliance initiatives that have come up. There were two watershed events that happened late in 2001. One was obviously the attack on the World Trade Center on September 11th. The other was in October of 2001, the Securities and Exchange Commission began investigating Enron. So as a result of those two events, we've seen a plethora of regulatory compliance initiatives from different governmental regulatory, state, insurance, and other initiatives. And this slide just represents some of these regulatory compliance initiatives. And if we go to slide 4, we see that the life is not getting any easier. These were additional initiatives that came to the forefront in 2004 and 2005. We see additional regulatory compliance initiatives cropping up almost on a daily basis. For the purposes of this presentation, we're going to take a little closer look at one specific initiative. That's the Visa and MasterCard PCI initiative. So slide 5 kind of gives us an overview of the whole impetus for regulatory compliance. The regulators have multiple goals. In some cases, they're interested in improving security of the national infrastructure, risk management across the enterprise from a financial or fiduciary perspective, ensuring that the financial data that gets reported is indeed correct, and also to ensure that customer information, things like driver's license numbers, social security numbers, credit card information, that those are secured. Because of all of these regulations and initiatives, we're seeing that customers are having to look at driving investment in several areas of their enterprise. So customers are having to invest in people. These are professionals that with a background to come into an organization and help them understand and meet the different parts of the relevant regulatory requirements that customers are compelled to adopt. We also see that business processes in a lot of cases need to be re-engineered in order to comply to the different regulatory components. And we're also seeing that customers are having to make significant investments in technology to do things like encrypt sensitive data, to protect sensitive production data, to perform audits and be able to manage the amount of data that results from a robust auditing environment, and then also to be able to understand from a real-time perspective what's actually happening within their IT operations. So the key message is that customers are having to invest in this technology. We're going to take now, and on slide six, we're going to take a closer look at one specific compliance example, and that's the Payment Card Industry Initiative from Visa. This initiative was enacted by not only Visa, but all the major cardholder companies to ensure that their partner vendors comply with certain conditions. This standard is used by all of the major credit card issuers. It's not a optional requirement. It's a mandatory, mandated requirement. There are severe penalties placed on the PCI vendor when they do not comply. There is synchronicity with other compliance initiatives. So as we talk about PCI and we talk about the technology that IBM can provide to help a customer conform to the PCI, we'll find that this technology and these approaches are also relevant to other regulatory initiatives as well. And while we're talking about the main thrust of this is to comply for reasons to avoid either financial penalties or government sanctions, a lot of customers are finding that this compliance and the initiatives behind it can be used as a competitive advantage. So if I'm a credit card provider and I can demonstrate to my cardholders that I am doing the due diligence in order to protect their sensitive data, a lot of times that will make for a much more satisfied cardholder and help to increase cardholder and customer loyalty. So they're viewing this as a competitive advantage. So what we've done here is we've pulled some specific parts out of the PCI. And PCI consists of a total of 12 requirements. Many of the requirements I've not listed because customers are already doing taking the due diligence steps in order to satisfy those requirements. But I pulled out a series of requirements. Requirement three is to protect stored data, what's also termed a data at rest. Requirement seven is to restrict access to a business need to know. Requirement 10 is to be able to track and monitor all of the access to the network and the cardholder data. And requirement 10.7 is that to make sure that there is an audit trail and also to make sure that the history associated with that audit is kept for a period of time that is consistent with its effective use. So we should be on slide eight. And then I took the same set of initiatives, and I laid over the top of it technology from IBM that will help your company comply with those specific requirements. So for the area of protecting stored data or data at risk, we can offer the IBM data encryption tool for DB2 and IMS databases. Where we want to restrict access to a business need-to-know perspective, this is where we would implement with version 8 of DB2, multi-level security implemented via RACF. Tracking and monitoring access to network resources, we can provide two different solutions for that, and we'll see some more details in a minute. And then be able to maintain your audit history for a period of time, we offer the IBM Data Archive Expert. So the first slide, and we're actually should be on slide nine now. The first product, the first technology we're going to introduce is the IBM Data Encryption Tool for DB2 and IMS databases. So slide 10 gives a visual representation of clear key processing. When I perform encryption on the Z-Series platform, I have two choices of implementation, clear key or secure key. Clear key is basically an implementation that performs the encryption and decryption services in operating system storage. There is a performance benefit for doing this. There is a very slight exposure from a operating system storage perspective in that there is in the address space performing the encryption, decryption request, the unencrypted key label is visible. However, there is no documented interface to help you locate this information. And ZOS does a very good job of address space integrity. It's very difficult from one address space from a problem program to be able to look at another address space as operating system storage. So it is a relatively secure implementation. And as we'll see, the next slide represents secure key processing, which is a different implementation that is available on the Z-Series platform, where the encryption and decryption is actually performed within the tamper-resistant device. This, again, provides no visualization of the key value in operating system storage, but it brings with it a performance a penalty. And based upon measurements, we see that it's somewhere between 2 to 2.5 times more efficient to implement clear key encryption than secure key encryption. And the data encryption tool for DB2 and IMS databases provides you with the ability to implement either clear or secure key based upon the security requirements of your particular enterprise. So now we should be on slide 12. Fundamental to the encryption tools, encryption and decryption capability is leveraging a component of the operating system referred to as the ICSF, or the Integrated Cryptographic Services Facility. This facility has been around as well, well proven. The technology has been in use since the early 1990s. It is strategic, so we've seen some recent hardware announcements in the area of encryption. All of the IBM Z-Series encryption technologies leverage the services of ICSF. ICSF provides a number of different functions. Included in this is the key creation and distribution of public and private keys, the creation and management of key labels, and key labels are actually used by the encryption tool. It also allows me the ability to control through the SAF, which is a component of RACF and other security packages, access to ICSF and access down to the level of securing an individual key so that only a certain user with a profile, RACF profile, has the RACF authority to use that particular key label. So it provides some very granular levels of security within the ICSF environment. So the next slide, which is slide 13, gives us an overall view of the cryptographic environment as it runs on Z-Series. This slide shows on the upper right-hand corner, talks about Z9, Z890, Z990. We're going to see in the next slide, we're not going to talk much about the Z800 and Z900 platforms. Quite frankly, from a performance perspective, I would encourage you to upgrade to a more current hardware environment because some of the penalties that you would see in performance are very dramatic. So this slide describes the ICSF environment. The key to this is that we've got two different implementations. On the left-hand side on the hardware level, we have CPACF, which is the clear key implementation. On the right-hand side, we have the Crypto Express 2 coprocessor, which is an additional hardware feature that needs to be acquired. This is where we perform secure key encryption. And even with clear key encryption for the implementation of the encryption tool for DB2 and IMS databases, we do require a Crypto Express 2 coprocessor to be enabled in order to perform the key management and encryption and decryption of the key labels. The next slide talks about the hardware evolution, and again, this is where you can see from the early 1990s where we had implemented encryption on the Z800s and Z900s to where we introduced a Crypto Express 2 coprocessors with the later generations of the Z890s, the Z990s, and now the Z9s. Some dramatic improvements in performance, in some measurements as much as 18 times better performance on the Z9 platform. So the message to take away from this, again, is that to perform encryption, you probably need to be running relatively current Z-Series hardware. And we've also made some recent hardware announcements on the latest versions of the Z9, which show some additional performance improvements in the area of encryption. So slide 15 introduces you to the IBM data encryption tool for DB2 and IMS databases. Its implementation from a DB2 perspective is through a standard DB2 edit proc. We support all versions of DB2. We basically generate one of several forms of the edit proc depending upon your choice of clear or secure key encryption. Because it's implemented via edit proc, encryption and decryption occurs at the row level. So when I declare an edit proc for a table, every row in that table is encrypted. It exploits ICSF and the CPACF in the event of a clear key encryption choice, requires no application change, and is relatively fast to implement. And then I provide a little additional information about edit procs from a background perspective. Edit procs transform data on inserts, updates, or loads. The transformation affects the entire row. All the IBM utilities are supported. It's implemented via a create table and requires an unload and reload of the data in order to perform the initial encryption of the table. So we should be on slide 16. This kind of summarizes the implementation of the tool, describes in a very high level the steps that would be needed in order to implement the data encryption tool for DB2 and IMS databases, and then subsequently perform encryption on a particular DB2 table. All right, so now we're going to address the second initiative within PCI, and that's the access for need-to-know only. We're going to discuss very briefly version 8 on ZOS multi-row security. So we implemented this with version 8, and we have a new attribute, a column attribute, known as security label. So in the past, what customers had been doing to perform row-level or very granular security is that they've either been using views. Some customers have implemented either through a DB2 edit proc or a field proc some sort of exit-based row-level security implementation. So what we're now doing with version 8 is that we're in conjunction with some capability built into the latest version of RACF, we're allowing the establishment of a hierarchy. And the hierarchy consists of various security labels that imply certain levels of access to data. The next slide shows an example of this. So let's say we have a security scheme where we have security labels that are associated with colors. And each row in the table in its security label column would indicate the color, in this example, associated with that particular row. Associations would then be made within RACF to specific users that would imply access to certain classes of security labels. So, for example, in this example, Sally has access to a security label called Rainbow. And Rainbow, in essence, is associated with all of the colors that in turn identify different levels of security. So Sally would be able to read, in this particular example, all of the rows represented in this table, where on the other hand, Sam at the bottom, because his sect label is called Sunset, is only able to access the rows that are associated with red, orange, or yellow security label. So we're on slide 21 now. And what this is really doing is it's allowing me at a runtime to associate a specific user to specific rows or specific pieces of data. Each table needs to have a column defined as security label. Each row value then has a specific security label associated with it. RACF is the repository that manages all of these different security label definitions. Rows are saved in terms of insert updates or load. The initial value is set in one of those operations. And then every access to the row is checked. If the security label allows access, then the row value is returned. Otherwise, there is no data available from the application perspective. It does require a certain release of the ZOS operating system, mainly to ensure that you're running, I believe, RACF 1.9. That's the minimum level of RACF that's required in order to implement the RACF support for Security Label. I'm on slide 22 now, and this basically describes a process that you would go through in order to implement multi-level security for DB2. Slide 23 discusses the differences between users and objects. And we see from the bottom bullet that objects could be any system resource, a data set, a table, a row, or a particular DB2 command. Slide 24 talks about the fact that in order to secure things other than rows, you need to enable the DB2 RACF interface, and the DSNX @XAC is the exit that enables the RACF to DB2 interface. If you're only interested in performing row-level security, you do not need to implement the RACF DB2 interface. You can continue to use your native grant and revoke authorization scheme to control all the other types of objects and only implement row-level security for your active data. We should now be on slide 26. This talks about the third area of compliance, and this is audit trace management and reporting. So we're going to see an example of how to use the DB2 Tivoli Omegamon performance expert to perform this task. Elaine is going to talk about a much better solution that allows you to generate audit information and track activity on your DB2 system. We're also going to show that once we generate the audit detail report out of the OMPE performance reporter, we're also going to show how you can load this information into the performance database to allow for long-term storage of audit data and provide the ability to use SQL-based reporting. We're going to show the use of the performance database, and you may be aware that the OMPE product brings with it a component called the performance warehouse. However, the performance warehouse only supports accounting and statistics data. So we're going to need to load the data into the performance database in order to perform this auditing and reporting. We're going to show the creation and collection of ad hoc trace data. In other words, I'm going to actually start the trace using the facilities of Omegamon Performance Expert, but in actuality, you would have probably started the audit trace outside of any sort of interaction and run that on an ongoing basis. The next slide just describes at a very high level some of the architectural components of Omegamon Performance Expert. We're going to be focusing on the DB2 PM batch reporting component. The next slide describes a summary of functions available with Omegamon Performance Expert. And what we're going to actually be focusing on is trace collection and also reporting. So we should be on slide 29. Slide 29 shows us an example of a way to interact with a component called collect report data, CRD. So for the purposes of this scenario, I went out and started a trace collection interactively. So you can see from this screen I'm asking trace configuration to collect only audit records. I'm going to do, once I configure the trace, it's going to immediately start. The next slide shows I define a destination. In this case, it's a sequential data set. I can also put limits on the trace, so I can, in this case, say I want the trace to run a total of 600 seconds, or I want it to run until I collect a total of 2,000 records. Slide 31 shows that I can, because I've selected the audit trace class, that's class 8, I also have the ability to select or deselect specific IFKIDs. In this case, I'm going to collect all of the IFKIDs that are associated with audit class 8. Slide 32 then also reminds us that we also need to, if I want to audit data set or table access, I've got to start the audit trace, but then I also have to audit the table, alter the table for audit. So this just shows an example of me using the DB2 administration tool in order to change the attribute on a table to audit all. Once that's done, we start to trace. We've collected the data. Once the data has been collected, I can then interact with another component of OMPE called IRF, or the Interactive Report Facility. This will then generate the necessary utility control statements and the JCL to submit and generate the Omegamon Performance Expert Audit Detail Report. So this is telling me, in looking at the screen, we can see that I'm specifying that I want to generate a detail report. Even though I collected all of the different audit trace classes, the IFKIDs, I'm only going to report on DDL and DML. So I've selected those two. I'm not going to report on any of the other audit types for this report. Once I generate the command, this next screen, which is slide 34, shows the file commands that get generated. Those are the ones that actually contain the load control compatible records to load into the performance database. The bottom report shows an example of the audit report. Again, auditors could use this to look for audit type activity, but it's probably more relevant to load the data into the performance database and then allow the auditors to run SQL to look at the data. So what we then do is that we go and we need to create the tables to contain the data. So there is a set of control load control samples in the SampLib that contains the load statements necessary to load the performance database. On the bottom, we see again an example of using DB2 administration tool to generate the JCL and control statements needed to run the load utility. So the next slide, which is slide 36, shows the result of me running the load. So I've used the DB2 Control Center just to display the contents of the audit table. Just a couple of notes. One is that I did not have the appropriate IFKID class running, so the table OBID was untranslated. In this case, I'd need to do a join with sys_tables in order to get the table name. And then I see over on the right for updates, we actually generate the log RBA. So that's the log RBA associated with the logical unit of work for the first update. That would be something that I could use in conjunction with a log analysis tool like the IBM DB2 Log Analyzer to go and actually look at the specific before and after image of the changes associated with that logical unit of work. So in summary, we've seen that we can use Omegamon Performance Expert to manage the collection of the audit traces, formatting and loading of the data, and we can use SQLs to perform the reporting. While we can set this up and run this in batch, it does require a lot of ongoing maintenance and intervention by the DBAs. And this intervention by the DBA to load this data is actually viewed as a security risk. We see that we may have to do some additional work to join the catalog table or to perform some additional analysis with a log analysis tool. Elaine is now going to talk about a product called the DB2 Audit Management Expert. This provides a much more secure and functional solution. Whatever method you use, however, over time, you're going to end up collecting a massive amount of audit information. And the size of this repository can grow exponentially, which is going to cost you lots of storage and associated management issues. And there are also regulatory compliance initiatives that define how much audit data you're actually allowed to keep from a security perspective. So in order to better control and manage the long-term storage of DB2 audit data, we need to introduce an archival methodology. So once Elaine has finished talking to you about Audit Management Expert, I'm going to come back and very briefly introduce you to another product called the DB2 Data Archive Expert. So Elaine, I'm going to turn the presentation over to you now. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ernie. As we all know, we're going to be on slide, well, it's 38. We're looking at how we can analyze and audit data, as Ernie was discussing. And I don't know about you, but if you look at everything he had to do through OMPE and you put yourself in the position of an auditor, they have to be in awe of things that they would have to know or depend on that DBA to get the information. Now, as we all know, the amount of corporate data being stored in databases have grown exponentially over the years, and this in conjunction with the proliferation of legal requirements, as described by Ernie, has made it imperative to audit the activities and the events occurring in DB2. And the auditors, as Ernie has mentioned, who are doing this, are very dependent on the DBA, which does provide perhaps a security risk. So I'd like each of you right now, a lot of you may not be auditors, but we have to consider what they have to go through. So I'd like each of you listening to put yourself into the role of an auditor. And on slide 39, I want to review some of the dilemmas that they have to face in this kind of a situation. So as an auditor, not knowing much about DB2, and maybe I've just listened to all these things that Ernie said I had to do or what had to be done, I don't even know where to start. So maybe my best thing is to go visit this person that has the responsibility of being a DBA. And I need to ask them, you know, I don't even know what kind of information is available. What can I get? How can I access it? Oh, I can't. I don't have the authority to do so. Well, can you help me? So I need information, the kind of information I need as an auditor. I need to know how people are accessing the data stored in DB2. And I also need how to know how they're reading it, if they're reading it, by the way. But I only need it for specific users and files. Next week, though, I'm going to have different users and different file requirements. And sometimes I need to get that information all the time. Oh, okay, you can help me, but when can I get the reports and what format is it in? Can I take that data and manipulate it? Can I analyze it? Oh, by the way, can you help me sign on to the mainframe? I haven't been there for quite a while. Now, this dependency reduces the productivity of the auditor and puts an extra burden on the DBA staff as well. So now that's great, but now let's look at from the DBA's perspective. So let's go to slide 40. And look how they have to deal with it. Now, the DBAs are getting directives from management to work with the auditors to gather the required information. And the requirement to audit select statements, as well as insert, update, and delete, requires turning on an audit trace for, quote, sensitive tables. Now, this raises some questions in the mind of the DBA. So, for example, what classes do I have to turn on to get that audit information? What tables need to have the audit turned on? How much data is going to be produced? Do the tables have to be audited all the time? What is the overhead on my subsystem? What format does this auditor need the information in? How is it going to be reported? Maybe I'm really the new auditor. Is this responsibility being dumped on me? So let's go to slide 41 and look at, Sammy, an optimal solution to helping an auditor's woes regarding DB2. And the optimal solution would be to have a tool which would allow them to work independently from the DBA, yet not require them to have to learn DB2, or for that matter, log on to that mainframe green screen. Horrendous. The solution should be able to collect and correlate information from the DB2 log, as well as from the audit traces, and hopefully store this information in a centralized location that auditor can easily access. In addition, the auditor should have the ability to recall audited information on an as-needed basis because, as you heard Ernie tell us, they need to be able to provide some historical information upon request. The tool should be able to provide the auditor with a wide spectrum of information, including the ability to report on failed access attempts due to the lack of authorization by the user. That's very important in today's world. The ability to capture insert, update, delete, and at times select activity on sensitive tables. The ability to report on create, alter, and drop operations. Utility access, the issuance of DB2 commands, and explicit grants and revokes. Another highly desirable option would be to allow the auditors to specify filter criteria such as user IDs, names of objects, applications, time of day, all in order to limit the amount of information being reported on. So let's go to slide 42 and look at the architecture of IBM's new DB2 Audit Management Expert product. As you look at this slide, this product was designed with the auditor in mind. Starting in the middle of the diagram, where the number 1 is in the blue square, you'll see that the Audit Management Expert server and an audit repository. The information needed by auditors can normally be found where? In the DB2 log or SMF. And as mentioned previously, auditors can't go in there and get the information out themselves. So with the audit repository, which is a set of DB2 tables, audit information can be stored for easy access by the auditor through a GUI interface. The Audit Management Expert server is a started task which interfaces with the audit repository and the audit expert agent, which is located at the bottom of the diagram where you see the number 2 in the blue square. There is one agent per subsystem. Now, the agent is the facility which collects the trace data and passes it to the server to store it in the repository. At the top of the diagram, where the number 3 is in the blue square, you can see there are two GUI interfaces. Both run on Windows 2000 or XP. Now, the optimal solution is one where the auditor has the ability to determine what information is gathered independently of the DBA. This makes him independent. And that is exactly what the administrator GUI on the left allows the auditor to do. The audit management expert administrator can define a set of collection profiles which selectively identifies what data is to be stored in that audit repository. Tables have been defined with audit, which is the responsibility of the DBA. That information is still gathered and stored in SMF. But the auditor no longer has to wait for the DBA to extract the information in order to get the reports or analyze the data, because being routed to the audit repository and with their GUI interface, they can get to that data quickly. The second GUI interface on the right is used for reporting analysis. This GUI requires a JDBC driver and DB2 Connect to connect to the Audit Management Expert repository. Auditors can use this interface to produce the reports they want when they want. And to reiterate, they do not have to use that green screen TSO interface. Now, Audit Management Expert provides a variety of reports. An auditor can generate an overview of all subsystems where audit data is being collected, or they can view information for a selected subsystem. There are also sets of detailed reports which can be viewed either graphically or in tabular format. So let's go to the next slide and start getting a peek at what the Audit Management Expert client starts looking like. Now, we're going to start with the administration client. So on slide 44, we have our first view of what this administrative client looks like. It is used to define the environment through the definition of a set of collection profiles. To begin, the administrator must log on to the Audit Management Expert server. And if you look at this slide in the middle where the green box is, you'll see where the logon information is entered. At the top of the panel, where you'll see there's a tab called Settings that's been highlighted, and below that is a list of available DB2 subsystems. Now, notice the dot next to D81B, and if you follow that down to the bottom, you'll see that we are connected to subsystem D81B. At the bottom of the drop-down list box where we have the subsystems listed, you'll see that there is an option to define servers. So in the box at the right, this is an overlay panel on this particular presentation, we show a list of servers defined. So the Audit Management Expert Administrator can define the subsystems and the servers using this interface. Let's go to slide 45. I'm sorry. On this slide, we're going to see some things about security. As mentioned previously, auditors are not necessarily knowledgeable about DB2, but they need to be able to audit the activities happening on that ZOS platform. Another bottleneck, other than the DBA, is they have to have the acquisition of security rights on the mainframe. And so security for Audit Management Expert is independent of that of DB2. The Audit Management Expert Administrator handles security through this GUI interface, and this means that the users of the tool are not defined users to DB2. Now, this actually protects DB2, as the auditors will not be able to manipulate any DB2 resources and consequently avoid any mistakes that they could make. In addition, not all auditors need to see the same information, so the internal security capability of Audit Management Expert enables the administrator to independently control who sees what. So as you look at this particular screenshot, you can see that for each user, there are different levels of capabilities possible. For example, they're able to connect to the subsystem. They can either create users, create groups, create profiles, edit profiles, etc. So all of this is handled through the administration client of the Audit Expert tool. On slide 46, as an auditor, I may need to create extract information for any number of tables, each having their own selection criteria. Without a tool, the auditor is at the mercy of the DBA, as we've been saying, and they have to provide to the DBA specific details and then wait for the results to get back to them. Now, if they make a mistake, if they forget to ask for something, as you saw Ernie forgot to ask for a particular IFKit or do a join, if they forget to ask for something that they thought was going to be there, and then they look at the results, they now have to go back to that DBA and repeat this whole process. Well, with the DB2 Audit Management Expert product, the auditing staff has control over its own destiny. Through the definition of a collection profile, a set of configurable rules can be defined which describe the audit data that's to be stored in that audit management expert repository. Now, earlier I stated that the audit management expert uses the audit trace facility of DB2, and that is, but that controls what's being actually captured, and again, that's still going into SMF. But using the collection profile, the auditors can determine what information they want to redirect into the audit management expert repository. So this allows them to get that information that they need at the time they need it. So this is really a good thing. On slide 47, we see that to define a collection profile, the expert administrator first gives the profile a name and a description, as you can see in the blue circle. Below that, there's some text, which talks about other steps in the definition of the profile, which can pick out which objects, which event data is going to be collected into the audit repository. In addition, users and applications can be included or excluded from the collection of information. So as the administrator continues with the identification of the collection profile, on the next slide we'll see how he handles the source. The source really serves as the template for the profile. It is where the administrator selects a subsystem, which in turn can provide a list of objects from which they can choose. These are the objects that we want to capture information into our audit repository. Now, if you notice at the bottom in the blue circle, there is a push button entitled New Rule. This allows the administrator to specify the rule which determines which data is going to be stored in the repository. And on the next slide, slide 49, we're going to see what they would see if they push that button. In the left frame is a list of the steps that the administrator will go through to define a collection profile. And the first part of the rule is the definition of a schedule. So you have a choice. As the administrator, always says that the audit data will continuously be captured or the collection can be set up below onto the schedule. And so rather than having to rely on the schedule of the DBA, the auditor is now in control of their destiny to determine their own schedule. And it's also independent of the DBA, not only that you're not interfacing with them, but this allows the auditor to manage or audit what the DBA activity is as well. Okay, that's really an important point. On the next slide, slide 50, we're going to see what is available to be audited. And this is kind of interesting because what I mentioned earlier, sometimes auditors don't even know what kind of information they can get from DB2. So this provides a list of the things that they can choose from. So we have things here like to audit or not audit all failed authorizations, successful authorization changes, failed authorization ID changes, successful grants and revokes, etc. So they can click the checkbox and pick what they want to get. On the next slide, we're going to be looking at the system called Targets, and this panel represents a list of objects from which the auditor can choose to audit. Now, the auditor doesn't have to know the name. They don't have to know the exact name of the table. We do support wildcarding. As you can see, we have a schema and a name. The percent sign is our wildcarding sign. And the objects to be audited can be, you know, just like the typical GUI interface, you move them over to the right, the ones that you want to audit, and then we would get our list of audits. Now, today, you'll see that the type has a little table-like looking icon. The only type that we have today is table. We plan to enhance that in the future and add other object types as well. On the next slide, which is slide 52, we can now see where the administrator can specify events they want to capture. So the auditor, again, we do have to rely on the DBA to get audit defined on the table definition. But once that's done, the auditor could control what they are going to capture into the audit management repository. Remember, this information is still going into SMF and actually the DB2 log as well. Now, notice that the heading on the columns, we have this table type, the schema name, the table name, and then you have successful first read. It's important to note that only the first access to the object is recorded by an object trace. So they can check whether they want the successful first read or the first change. On the next slide, we can see where the auditor can check which auth IDs are to be included or excluded. Note the two tabs to the right of the auth ID at the top. We have WS name and WS TRAN for handling distributed applications as well. On slide 54, we see that the administrator can choose which plans are to be included or excluded. Now, all of these options empower the administrator to make decisions independent of the DBA. On slide 55 is a report called the Profile Summary. This report summarizes the rules and definitions chosen by the administrator when creating the profile. And as we see in our particular case, our rule states that we're going to be using the always active as our timing. Next, that we have a list of the events to be audited, and these were identified in the previous slide by the audit management expert administrator when defining the rule. And then below that is a list of the tables to be audited by this rule, followed by a list of the user IDs and plan filters. Now, on the next slide, we see the next step. We've defined our collection profile. And the next step, the collection, we have an option, say, a tab that says collections. And this is where we're going to associate a collection for a particular subsystem to a collection profile, to that set of rules that we just defined. Now, as you can see, there's a status column. What you have is you can either make these active or inactive. So for a particular subsystem, you can activate a particular collection profile or your, quote, rules. Now, to summarize, the administration client can be used to create users, assign permissions, create groups, assign users to groups, modify the log level of specific agents, create collection profiles, associate that collection profile with a specific subsystem, issue authorizations, and then actually you can edit the JDBC connection to the repository as well. So all of this is built into this administration GUI interface. On the next slide, we're going to start going in and looking at the report client. On slide 57, this is the second GUI interface. And this is the interface that the typical auditor would use. The interface that we just saw, the administration interface, is the setup, where we're setting up what we're going to collect. But the other auditors may not even do that. You have a specific set of auditors that would do that. On this particular interface, this is where the typical auditor would go in and extract information, not only from the audit expert repository, but you're going to see that we can actually get information from the DB2 log as well. Again, they would have to sign on just as they did for the administrative client. On slide 58, slide 59, we have the first reporting view. Now, if you look up where the number one is in the blue, there we were originally on the login tab. Right now, we're on the reporting tab. And this particular report that you're seeing is called the overview report. If you look at the text box where it says reporting overview, the arrow is pointing down to overview. Overview is highlighted in yellow. This is the overview report. If you look at the middle of it, we're going to describe the different parts, but number two is where the filtering can be so that the auditor can filter out what they want to see in this report. And number three at the right panel is really where the body of the report is stored. So let's go to slide 60. We're going to break this down a little bit. We're going to look at the left. You're going to see the filtering options. And you can see that in the blue box, where the thing reporting options is pointing to, the auditor is able to filter on date, range, and time, by user, or by activity type. On slide 61, we see at the very bottom of that filter frame that the auditor can optionally edit exception thresholds or view or choose to view historical information. On the right, the box outlined in the blue line, we can see a list of activities for which the auditor may establish thresholds. Now, the choices can access attempt, like first access attempts, first read of audited objects, first change of audited objects, the create, alter, and drop of audit of objects, etc., all in that list. That's the list of activities that they can set these thresholds for. To the right are two columns. The left column represents the threshold where anything below that number would be considered normal activity. There's nothing that we need to really focus on. On the right, where the red X is above the column heading, those are the critical things. If that threshold exceeded, a red X is going to be displayed, which would identify or notify the, or rather alert the auditor that they need to go in and drill down and look and see what kind of activity is happening in that area. As we said earlier, that they can go in and look at collection history. And so we're going to go to slide 62 and continue looking at this report. We're looking at the section, the body of it, outlined in blue. Look where the number one is at the top. And there's a list of activities, just like that list of activities where we set the threshold. This time the activities are rather horizontal rather than vertical. And this is what they establish the thresholds for. So, for example, the A is access attempts, and the B is for the first read of audited objects, etc. On the far right, you'll see three possible statuses, a red X for critical, a triangle with yellow triangle for warning, and a normal, which would be the green check mark. Now, if you look below in the object where the number 2 is, outlined in yellow, there's a box that contains 9 little smaller boxes. In the first box, there's an A. That A corresponds to the A that's above by the number 1 for access attempts, and the B, for example, goes with first read of audited objects. Now, the A has a green check mark indicating that everything is normal in the system for access attempts. But the box with the C in it has a red X, which is a critical exception for first change of audited objects. Now, if you also look at this box that's in yellow, above these little boxes, there's the subsystem ID. And at the bottom in blue are the available dates, because remember, we can also look at history. Now, in this particular screenshot, we have the one box with the 9 boxes in it. I'm looking at one subsystem. I can look at multiple subsystems as an auditor, so I would have multiple boxes with 9 little boxes in it and the rest of that empty space on this panel. Now, on slide 63, we see an example of the collection history display. In the left frame, where the number 1 is displayed, the auditor can fill again the date and time range of interest. Where you see the number 2, they can select the view or all the subsystems or a particular subsystem. And where you have the number 3, there are some push buttons which would allow the auditor to refresh the information or customize the colors and that sort of thing, where they can make it look the way they want it to or even refresh the panel. In the right time frame is the timeline indicating if and when information has been collected. There is a hover cursor that you can put above where any one of those circles and then get information about the date, time, subsystem, and status. So this enables the auditor to know if there's any information available for during that time frame. On slide 64, we can see an example of the filter criteria. The frame in the middle gets displayed when the button on the left is pressed, and the auditor can filter by user, moving that particular user's down to the box below, objects, or by plan. On slide 65, we're going to see a different type of report. We can drill down. If you notice where we had the reports before were overviews, up by the number 4, right above that is the word overview. If you look to the right of that, subsystem is highlighted in yellow. The reports shown by subsystem, you can look at them through a scaling report graphs using linear or logarithmic access. The reports produced by DBAs normally are just very basic columnar outlines or layouts. And with the audit management expert GUI, auditors are able to produce graphical representations which enable them to quickly identify problem areas. So the graph with the number 1, which is the entitled absolute of activity, note at the bottom axis you've got that A, B, C, D indicator at the bottom of the graph. That again represents those thresholds that we are able to set. If you look at the bottom by the number 5, you again see where those particular entries are, so you can relate the A, again, is access attempts, and F is assignment of change of auth ID. So these relate back to those thresholds. Then we have the colors. There's green telling you whether it's okay, and then the thresholds on the side, rather the access on the left, tells you the counts of activities, the number of accounts. And these all can be, customized if you wish. Where the graph for the number 2 is, over to the right, this is another example of threshold summary by day. The graphs show the threshold status, in other words, how many critical, how many warnings, how many normal occurrences. And the third graph at the bottom is the absolute count of activity by day. Again, note the left frame where the number 4 is. That enables the auditor to provide filters to limit the information displayed, things like time ranges, users, type of activity, time period, etc., all can be customized for these summary reports. On slide 66, we're drilling down even deeper. We're now going to see detail reports. The top graph where the number 1 is the top 5 audited objects, in other words, the most actively accessed objects. The middle graph where the number 2 is posted is the top 5 users. The third graph at the bottom is the count of the first changed objects by day. Note the first changed nomenclature. Audit traces, again, only capture that first change in a transaction. Once again, the left time frame where the number 4 is in the blue square, this is the filtering. There's some things by days, minutes, hours. And at the very top of the slide where the blue circle is, you'll see that they have an option to get a list of displays to choose from. Now, the current display is for first changes of audited objects. If you go to the next slide, slide 67, if you push on that drop-down list box, you can see that they have a list of things that they can choose from to get more detailed reports for each of those, utility access, DB2 commands, et cetera. On slide 68, we see that the audit management expert allows users to extract detailed data and actually copy it to a clipboard or export it to a file. You see the buttons put outlined in blue kind of at the bottom third of the slide. And they can take that information out, put it into any other kind of reporting tool. They could use it then to share with others or to do some analysis work. On slide 69, now just before we go to slide 69, on slide 68 you see that the DB2 systems is highlighted in green. When we go to slide 69, you're going to see that objects are now highlighted in green. So this is where we're going to be looking at the subsystem side. We're going to be looking at it from the objects again, top 5 objects, top 5 users, count of success or failure by day, similar kinds of detailed reports, but it was at the object level. On slide 70, again at the object level, again they can copy or export this information to a file or to a clipboard for further analysis. Now, we've been looking at all of this, looking at the audit information, and we mentioned earlier that you could get some information from the DB2 logs. So in the next slide, slide 71, this is another option with the audit management expert tool. You'll see in the blue circle that we have a log analysis capability. Basically, what we're providing is a GUI interface to get log analysis data. So on slide 71, we're starting to see where we're going to push that. We're going to switch to the log analysis wizard. So this is what we're going to do. And on slide 72, this will enable the auditor to generate reports detailing the changes that have occurred in particular tables within a given period of time. On the left, you can see where the auditor can start by selecting the objects they want to see information on. If you go to slide 73, you'll see that they have a filter is circled in blue, and they can pick and choose. It's got the thing about syslog range, statement types, whether they want to include inserts, updates, deletes, do they want to ignore catalog tables. So basically, this is a GUI interface to a log analysis type of functionality that just comes with the product. It's not an additional product that you have to acquire. This comes with the product. On the next slide, as we mentioned many times, auditors are not necessarily knowledgeable about DB2 or the mainframe, and if you start talking about JCL, you are out of their range. The audit management expert, though, can generate the JCL to extract the information from the log for the auditor through this GUI interface. And what they have to do is they have to sign on using the GUI interface, no green screen. And on slide 75, they can view the log analysis reports online. Note where the blue rectangle right above table-looking thing, the things they can do, they can retrieve job parameters, they can view the reports, they can delete reports, they can refresh reports. So the audit management expert offers a full inventory of log analysis reports, including committed activity, uncommitted activity, summary of reports, detail reports, showing all of the before and after images, and actually even rollback activity. On slide 76, to summarize the audit management expert offering, we allow auditors to work independently from the DBA. Audit information is stored in a central repository, which the auditor has access to. The GUI interface eliminates the need for having mainframe knowledge or even having to get onto that ugly old green screen thing. Auditors do not have to have a DB2 ID, thereby we're protecting the DB2 data from mistakes. Auditors are in control of their own destiny. They can specify their own filters, generate their reports on their own schedule. And it can provide information from not only the audit trace information, but the logs. And again, another important thing is they can also audit things that DBAs are doing within the subsystem as well. With that, I'm going to pass control back to Ernie so he can talk to you about our data archive expert.
Thank you, Elaine. And yes, I think that your solution is much easier to implement than the scenario I went through with a Megamon Performance Expert. However, regardless of the way that you choose to collect your audit data, you're going to quickly discover that over time, you're going to be dealing with a significant amount of data, which will have immediate relevance, but as you move forward in time, will probably be accessed less and less. However, there are a number of specific regulatory requirement initiatives where retention of data is a key component, and it spells out within the policy how long data needs to be retained. However, further complicating that issue, there are other initiatives that require, for security and confidentiality requirements, that data be destroyed or deleted after a certain period of time. So you're going to be challenged on a number of different fronts with how to best manage and control the amount of data that remains on your operational audit tables. So we're going to talk now, and I should be on slide 77, about an archiving solution called the IBM DB2 Data Archive Expert, version 2. Slide 78 gives us an overview from an architecture perspective of the archiving solution from IBM. We can see from this that you have active data. Active data is what is also referred to as operational data. Our archiving strategy allows two different types of archives to be generated. One is referred to as the table archive, and this is nothing more than a set of relational tables, either in the same DB2 subsystem, a subsystem on Z, maybe in another LPAR, or actually those table archives could even be a DB2 UDB instance running on AIX. We also support something called a file archive, which is a non-relational store, DASD or tape, that is stored off-site for longer-term retention and maybe not immediate access for retrieval. We also introduced a multi-tiered approach where I can initially archive data from the operational tables to a table archive for a period of time and then subsequently elect to move those archives from the table archive to a file archive. We also have a similar set of processes to manage the retrieval of the archive data for ad hoc reporting requirements as they arise. Slide 79 just gives us a little more information about the choice of archiving strategies that we have. The idea is that we reduce operational costs by moving needed but infrequently accessed data off of the operational data store into some other data store, either relational or flat file, thereby allowing you to achieve better DASD utilization on your operational data store. Removing unaccessed or unneeded data contributes to the efficiency of the applications. There's less data to be materialized when I do things such as table space scans. Utilities run faster. Recovery at an offsite disaster recovery takes less time because there's less data that needs to be restored, and the benefits go on. The other thing is that a lot of customers have written customized archiving solutions which are embedded within the application. This removes that requirement from your application's development sphere. Slide 80 talks about a component of Data Archive Expert. And when you talk about archiving data, you very quickly broach the subject of relational relationships between multiple tables in an application's set. So, for example, I may have a customer record in what's called a parent table, which defines the customer, but then there may be relationships to things like customer accounts. I may have a relationship to a customer account activity. When I elect to archive all of the data associated with that particular customer, I need to understand the relationships between the parent table and all of the related child tables as well. Sometimes that information is described in the DB2 catalog, so it's relatively easy to access. Other times, customers have elected to implement application enforced RI for performance reasons, and so those relationships are a little harder to extract. So we provide a component which is actually a separate product that is part of a number of different IBM tools, including the Data Archive Expert, called the DB2 Grouper. So DB2 Grouper provides different mechanisms to help discover both enforced and unenforced RI, store that information into a set of metadata tables that can then be used by products like Data Archive Expert to identify relationships that are necessary to create and execute a consistent archival and retrieval process. So we're going to talk now about a specific example of using Data Archive Expert. And what I've done is I've taken the audit table that I created in my Omegamon Performance Expert scenario, and I'm going to introduce this table into an archive process. So the first thing that we need to understand is there needs to be a unique index on the parent table to help ensure that I can maintain row uniqueness as part of the archive process. So as delivered, the audit table from Omegamon Performance Expert does not contain any indexes. So I first am going to create a unique index on the timestamp column, and I demonstrate how to do that using the DB2 data administration tool. Once I've done that, then I interact with the Data Archive Expert product. This is the first panel of the archive specification. This is where I can define a name, a description, and I can set up some default actions. So, for example, I can elect to, as the archive specification runs, I can delete the rows as they are archived. Alternatively, I can elect to do what's called a deferred deletion, where I run my archive, then I can, at some future time, elect to go back and complete the archive specification, which would then ensure that all of the archived rows had been deleted from the operational data store. When I do that, I may need to be concerned with changed data detection, because it is possible that although I should be archiving data that is not being accessed, there could have been some update that affected one or more archived rows. So the perform orphan row changed data detection flag just allows the Data Archive Expert to revalidate that what has been archived and about to be deleted has not been changed from the original time of the archival. I specify starting point table. You can see here that we also support remote targets. For this example, I'm going to be creating a table archive in the same DB2. So I'm going to select the starting point table, so we see that on 83. We can generate a wildcarded list of tables to pick from. We can specify filter database or a wildcarded table name. Once I identify the starting point table, if I want to relate other tables to it, I can do that either manually. I could have set relationships, non-enforced relationships up using Grouper, or if I had DB2 enforced relationships, I could select yes, and he would then go out and determine, based upon the information in the catalog, any of the parent-child row relationships that have been defined in the DB2 catalog. In this case, we have no RI because there is no relationships in the schema for the Omegamon Performance Expert audit tables. So I'm going to specify a no here. I also can determine whether or not I want to delete the rows. We'll turn around and for this execution, we'll specify yes. I could have specified no at this point and then elected to complete the specification when I run the specification in a future time, and we'll see an example of how we do that in a few slides. Slide 86 then shows how we define which rows in the parent row are selected for archival. This is the row filter specification. So for this example, I'm just going to specify a timestamp. And this row filter can be any legitimate where clause that would be specified on a select. Okay. Slide 87 is where I define the target for my archival process. As mentioned earlier, we're going to archive to a table. So I can specify the name of the table that I want created. And we can either use existing database table space names, or we can have the data archive expert will dynamically allocate these objects for us if they're not currently defined in the catalog. Slide 88 then shows the how I want to run the specification once it's been stored. We can also preview, based upon the row filter, the results of the archival. So this will allow us to sample the application of the defined row filter prior to actually running the archive to ensure that what we are affecting in terms of rows selection selected for archival is actually what we intended. So the next slide will show a result of the sampling. So we can see here that based upon our row filter that we are selecting from a timestamp perspective the rows that we intended to archive. So once we're happy with that, we then go back and execute the archive specification. The results of this archive run are shown on this screen, and they're also stored in the Data Archive Expert metadata tables for future reference. A couple of other considerations, as I mentioned earlier, we can choose to archive into an archive table. Once we've done that, we can then join the active table to the archive audit table if needed in order to materialize both current audit data and archived audit data. We also could have selected to put the archive target on another DB2, or we actually could have archived it to UDB on an AIX. Now, file archives work in a similar manner. The target is an unload file. In order to retrieve the data from the file archive, you need to run a retrieve specification, which will restore the data into a target table, which can be defined and managed by DAE. You can perform your reporting against the archived retrieved data, and then at that point, you can then drop the table if needed. So we're on slide 92. So to recap, what we've shown here is that for this specific compliance solution, PCI, we've identified a number of specific requirements that were called out in the regulation, and we've shown how we've got different technology from IBM that will allow you to meet the challenges of those requirements. So if you've got a specific set of regulatory requirements that you're wrestling with, you should be able to take this example, go back and review the requirements, and I think you're going to find that for most regulatory compliance initiatives that the core requirements are pretty much the same from initiative to initiative. So with that, I'm going to ask the moderator to take control of the call, and he'll open the call up for any questions that you might have. And again, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, sir. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you'd like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. And we will pause for just a moment to let everyone signal for a question. And again, I'd like to remind everybody that it's star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. And there are no questions at this time.
Okay. With that, I'd like to say thank you, everyone, for taking time out of your busy schedules to attend Compliance, not just for DBAs. A special thanks goes to our speakers, Elaine and Ernie, both from IBM, for being our speakers today. If you should have any questions, please do not hesitate to contact me, and I will be glad to put you in touch with a DB2 Tools sales rep or a DB2 Tools technical specialist. Our next DB2 Tools presentation is Maximize the Value of Your Data While Minimizing Costs on October 5th. Goodbye, everybody, and have a great day.
And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.